Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. Welcome in to the Storycraft Cafe. I am your host, Hank Garner. As always, today, joining me on the show, Jason Hamilton. You might know him as a mythic fantasy writer. You might know him from the many articles that he's written for Kindlepreneur. If you're in publishing and, you know, love to get nerdy about it, Jason is definitely the guy that you should follow there. He also has been one of the most prominent voices in talking about AI and specifically AI for writers. Over this last year, he has a YouTube channel, The Nerdy Novelist, which I'm an avid follower of. And he also has a website that you can join that he goes really deep on a lot of stuff, and that's Story Hacker. Or you might just know him as as the Story Hobbit. Jason Hamilton, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. That's a lot of things. I'm just now realizing
a lot of things in it. Yeah. Jason, I love to start with a fun icebreaker question, just to kind of get to know each other for just a moment. And one thing I love to ask people is, and because every writer that I've ever known has an answer to this, and they're all over the place, but what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Ooh, that's a good one. I don't know if this is the first memory of me wanting to be a storyteller, but the first time I ever remember telling a story was it would have been in elementary school. I had some assignment to write a story, and I remember writing something that was kind of I was kind of combining egregiously the concepts of The Hobbit and Superman.
So haven't we all, though?
Character, honestly, it was like a super hobbit, and like the plot was taken directly out of Superman, but with a hobbit instead of Superman. But that's how it goes, right? Like, but it was probably when in my early teens I started to get into, wasn't writing, it was filmmaking. And I made a Star Wars fan film at 14.
Nice.
And that was my first introduction to writing. And I remember it was after that point I started going to the library. And as a 14-year-old, right? I mean, how many 14-year-olds are reading, period? Let alone, like, I was getting giant biographies of Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, and then getting books on screenwriting and stuff like that. And I was really into that for a little while. Later during college, I sort of pivoted to be more about writing in general, not so much in the screenwriting or filmmaking. But I've always had just a very dear place in my heart for storytelling of any kind.
Nice. What was the catalyst for you to write your first book, and specifically the first book that you wanted to publish? You know, most people, and after having done 1,500 author interviews or so, that most of the time it's a bit of a circuitous route that gets people to writing and publishing. Only about a handful of people that I've talked to have had a singular focus. This is the only thing I've ever wanted to do and the only thing I've ever pursued. Most people, you pick up some experience here and over here, and all of that culminates in the writer's life. What was it that had you move from a hobbyist pursuit or something that, you know, you just did for your own pleasure and say, this is something I'm going to finish this, I'm going to hone it and craft it, and I'm going to publish it?
Yeah. So like the first time I ever Yeah, I got into writing a little bit late compared to some people, or at least got into self-publishing later than most people. I didn't even know self-publishing was an option or anything that people could do until I read a book that I actually really enjoyed and found out that it was self-published and reached out to the author. The author was gracious enough to give me a few pointers, and then I started reading books and then got into it that way. And that's actually learning about self-publishing was what propelled me forward to actually want to write my first book. Because I think what was holding me back before was just the idea of all of the gatekeepers that you have in traditional publishing and how difficult it was going to be to get. Like, I didn't really want to move forward unless I had a more of a guarantee that I could get my book out into the world. And that's what self-publishing offered me. So I'm actually not entirely sure which book I would count as my first one, because I have a book that is definitely my first complete novel that I put out there. It's my book Out of Shadow. It's the first of my Roots of Creation young adult fantasy series. And you know, that's a good book. That's a complete book, complete series now. But before that, I actually did publish a book. And this just goes to show how when you're just starting out, you have a lot to learn, right? I published, it was actually a series of 12 episodes of like a serial, and that I was just publishing on my website. I totally had that mentality of if you build it, they will come. Just put it on this website. I was like, people are going to find this. They're going to love it. They're going to join my mailing list, all this stuff. And
can I interject here for just a minute? That is very much a mindset that a lot of us got around 2013 or so, when all of these stories of the Kindle Gold Rush, you know, happened. And so, yeah, you're not alone in that thought process, by the way.
And like I said, you know, I wasn't there at that early Kindle Gold Rush era. Like, I was getting into this around 2018, I think, when my first book actually got published.
Around the second Kindle Gold Rush.
Yeah.
the KDP shakeups and all that.
Right. Yeah. A lot of that. And so this first book, it was a collection of these first 12 episodes that I had written, and it was a mess. And I say that largely not just because it was sort of episodic and didn't follow any particular story structure, but it was also, it didn't know what genre it was. So it was part urban fantasy, part time travel, part sci-fi, part superhero, with like a Terminator 2 sort of timeline or story to it. And it had this awful cover on it that had nothing to do with any of the genres that I was trying to target, and like all of the rookie mistakes that people make. Thankfully, I learned really fast in my second book. The first one, my Roots of Creation series, has done a lot better and was much more clearly targeting the right market. But
I think I've heard you tell that story, or at least part of that story, before. Is that the one that each of the covers had like a progression from an outline pencil drawing to the full color, which is a genius idea. I love that idea, but if you're doing it episodically, no one knows to follow along for that. So I love that idea, but I
can
understand why it might have fell flat.
Because it was kind of a superhero story, I thought I would do it. The covers in sort of a comic booky style, but it would start as a black and white comic book with no colors, and then it would slowly fill in as it went along. And I thought it was a brilliant idea at the time. And it does sound like a cool idea, but it wasn't like, you got to have a cover that's recognizable to the right audience. You just have to. Like, and I didn't realize that yet. So.
Well, and a brilliant idea and great marketing are not always the same thing, which is, you know, shame, but that's just a fact of the world we live in.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, so from there, after, you know, learning all the lessons that you learned there, then you started writing another series and you started finding, more success. You kind of dialed it in, figured out what you wanted to be, and had a better time with it.
Yeah. So my first proper attempt, was my Roots of Creation series. And that one, I tried to actually target the right market, have good covers. And that series did relatively well, certainly a lot better than the other one. It wasn't making like huge heaps of money or anything, but I launched it and I launched it to about $1,000 in the first month, which is really good for a debut series. And so I was pretty happy with that. And overall, that series, I think, did rather well. And I finished it. Let's see, there were 8 books in that series, all around the 60 to 75,000 word mark. So decent sized series. And I finished those books in about a little over a year, all 8 of them is how fast I wrote them. I was writing, like, looking back on it now, like, I was writing fast.
And just about every day you had to be pushing on it.
Oh yeah. I got into good habits. I was writing, 2,000 to 4,000 words a day, before work. I'd get up early so I could work on it. And, it was around that time I also got married. So that was like, there are a lot of things happening in my life at that time.
Yeah. So, at some point you put out a lot of books, you're having fun with it, but then there comes a wall. And I think a lot of authors experience that. It's not something we like to talk about. You call it burnout, call it frustration, call it, dashed hopes and dreams, whatever it is. It happens to a lot of people, and you just don't, either you don't feel like going on, or you sit down, the inspiration's not there. And I know we talk a lot about, you know, button the chair, you know, write even without inspiration, and all that sounds great, and those are great platitudes. But, you know, if you don't feel it, sometimes you just don't feel it. Tell me about that moment of, you know, desperation almost, or despair, or, you know, maybe it's not even that dramatic, but, you know, the feeling of, I'm a writer who just doesn't want to write.
Right. It's tough, man. It is a tough thing to deal with. So what happened is I finished that first series, the 8 books. I started on my second series, which by then I knew a lot more about writing and publishing. I wrote the first book in the second series. I actually wrote the first 2 books in the second series before I released them. And I knew the writing was there. It was way better than the writing of my first book, just because, you know, after you've written 8 books, it's definitely going to be better. Your writing is just going to be naturally better, right? And so I knew it was better. I got all my book covers. The book covers were beautiful. And this is a case of, like, they were actually good book covers, and I might have gotten the market wrong with them slightly, or I let my own vision for what they should look like interfere too much with what they really should have looked like. But they were gorgeous covers, and I still, to this day, love them. But I don't think they were quite right. But what happened is I had this huge launch plan. It was going to be bigger and better than my first launch. It was going to, I had everything planned. Everything was going to be perfect. The book was perfect. I had a much larger email list than I did the first time. Like, I was absolutely certain that it was going to do well and be like the thing that launched me to indie publishing stardom, right? And then it came out I ran about $1,000 worth of ads to the book. And the book made about $500.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it did worse than my first launch with a stronger marketing budget. And I was in the middle of writing the third book at that time. And after going through that whole thing where the entire thing just flopped, I just couldn't keep writing the third book. Like, it was so hard. And this is one of the things, just as a side note about burnout. Becca Syme, who is one of the leading experts out there about author burnout, is, she talks about what it is. And it's basically when you have a expectation of something and you work hard to get that expectation, and then you don't get your expected reward. And I say that very carefully because my expected reward was money. I wanted to earn money from this book, and that's what I was shooting for. And then when I didn't get the money, all of that hard work that I was doing, getting up in the wee hours of the morning to write, suddenly lost, like I just lost all motivation to do it. Had I instead had my focus on something more achievable that was within my control, because money isn't always within your control, but you do have certain other things in your control, like being able to just progress as a writer, to get better as a writer. You know, like if you're rewarding yourself by saying good job just for writing that day, then that could be incredibly fulfilling and that could be all you need. If your expectation is money, then if you don't get the money, and that's not entirely in your control, so you might not, then you're going to burn out. So that's just a little advice for anyone facing burnout, is make sure your expectation of reward is set on the right thing, which could be hard because most of us do want to make money. And so we do have that sort of, even if it's just a sneaking hope that we can get there. So that was that.
Looking back now, can you see what might have gone wrong with that book? Just, I mean, we're not,
yeah, I think it was,
dissect that necessarily, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think it was mostly the covers and the titles. I think the titles weren't very gripping enough. But I will also say this was 2 years later, and even in that short amount of time, things had not dried up, but algorithms had changed. Things were quite different in discoverability on Amazon. And I think that also played a part. Like, I think even if I had launched my first series again 2 years later, I wouldn't have had the same results as I did the first time, just because of the way algorithms change on Amazon and all of that. So it's a different world we live in now than it was. Not to say it's impossible to succeed as an author, but it requires definitely different tactics, I think.
Yeah. And you have to stay, that's the one thing about indie publishing, is that you have to be a publisher, and you, not only do you have to tell great stories, but you have to stay on top of not only marketing, but how the books are presented. And like you said, covers, titles, all of that goes into it. And not to discourage anyone from that, you just need to go in with your eyes open that these are realities that, you know, that have to be addressed.
Right. And, you know, I say this to a lot of people, but if you want to make money online, there are easier ways to do it.
Sure.
Like, there was a gold rush period with Kindle, and at that time it was a lot easier to make money. And that's the case with any kind of new emerging technology. There's always a gold rush period. TikTok has been going through a gold rush period where it's easy to get exposure for your books or your brand or whatever. And that one, it's still a viable option, but that one is not as effective as it used to be either. That's just the way it goes. So,
So you had that experience launching a second series, and you go through this period of burnout. I'm assuming you're still working with Kindlepreneur and all of the other roles that you played in the publishing industry. But your own fiction writing was suffering as a result of that. Tell me about when AI comes in, and you know what a sunrise moment that was to you know, see some hope again.
Yeah, it's great. So a little bit of background. I joined Kindlepreneur back in 2021.
Okay.
Yeah, so just as COVID restrictions were lifting and all of that, and from that, I was writing a lot more, but it was all nonfiction, right? Stuff for Kindlepreneur, and you find that when you're writing for your job, it doesn't make it easier to write for yourself because
sometimes
it's like
it makes it hard.
It's a double dose of writing. And so I was still writing a little bit. I managed to finish the third book of that series and the fourth book, although they took me like a year each to actually finish, as opposed to the eight books I had written in 1 year before, right? I was making a little bit of progress, kind of slowly coming out of that period of burnout, but it was still very hard. And then, of course, AI, about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, ChatGPT was launched, and I had actually been playing around with AI before that, with what we now know as GPT-3. So ChatGPT, when it first launched, had GPT 3.5. So this is like pre-ChatGPT levels of writing, and I played around with it. It wasn't very good.
Right.
I didn't find it to be that useful, and certainly wasn't saving me any time. And then ChatGPT came out, and just as a little bit of context, I have a website that I run on my own. My background is in website content, which is what I do for Kindlepreneur. And I have my own website that I was working on, where I would create these articles about mythology, because that was something that had, an important role in my books and things.
Sure.
And, so I went into that, and in one day wrote 16,000 words of content for that website using GPT 3.5. Now, looking back, a lot of those words weren't the best, because 3.5 is a weaker model, at least compared to what we have now.
Sure.
But that was eye-opening. Yeah. I was like, oh, there's something big here.
Right.
Now, I was using it for articles, which was easier to do. I tried to use it for fiction, and it wasn't. It could kind of help with certain things here and there. But the harder things to do, like writing prose, it wasn't able to do yet. GPT-4 came out, and then finally things started getting a little bit better. And I was like, okay, this isn't really good enough to actually write for me, but it's good enough to give me good ideas on where the story should go. It's good enough to write prose, like when you prompt it really heavily, it's good enough to write prose that can serve as a basis for me to go in and rewrite it.
Yeah.
In more in my own voice, which, believe it or not, you know, a lot of people are really opposed to AI doing all of the work for you. And I don't prescribe what is and isn't okay to use with AI, but a lot of people will use AI to write out the first draft, and then they will just rewrite it themselves, using the AI draft as just something to glance at now and then, right? And the reason that's effective is because so many of us, there are so many little tiny decisions that you're making with every sentence that you write, that it is really easy to run into decision fatigue with writing. And that's one of the things that was burning me out. Like, all that decision fatigue was piling up on me. And when I wasn't getting the return that I needed, like, it no longer became worth it to go through it. And that's how I burned out. And so the AI is a great way to sort of get past that and keep going. And so I got started writing again. I wrote a few short stories kind of experimentally with AI, in using AI in different capacities. And around a year ago, a little less than a year ago, so around last March or April, I believe, I was kind of obsessed with AI at this point. And I would watch like any YouTube video that came out on my feed that looked interesting. I was watching tons of videos about AI and prompting and everything. And I started to notice that nobody really had a good video out there about how to write a book with ChatGPT, like fiction. And then I found this one video that it was an hour long video about how to write fiction with ChatGPT. And the thing had like 20,000 views on it. And it was the only video on that person's channel. They didn't have any other videos at all. It was kind of frankly, a boring video. It was just, you couldn't see the person's face. It was just a guy talking over a screen share. And I saw that and saw how well that particular video was doing it. And I was just like, I could do that. I could do better than that. And so one day I literally turned on this webcam right here. I didn't have this microphone at the time. I had just a headset. And I found a way to record my screen while I was had my little head in the corner. And I just said, okay, most of the people out there who are making videos about this topic have never written a book in their life. And that is something that I have done multiple times. And I work for Kindlepreneur. I have, I list all the things. Yeah. And this is how I would actually do it. Like, this is the practical, real world way that you would actually do it. And that video, it's still, I think, it's one of my highest performing videos still. It's my very first one that I put out. Even though it's like way outdated, I still get a bunch of views. Like, I've remade the video twice since then, just because of how quickly AI advances. But that video still does very well for me. Still gets a couple hundred, or like 100 views a day or so. And that's where it started. I just made a few videos after that. I think the second one I made a few days later was about the best tools for writing fiction with AI. And just started making a few more, started to gain a following. And now we're coming up on 20,000 subscribers. So,
wow.
Pretty cool story.
Yeah, absolutely. You've done quite a number of videos about developing super prompts and how they can help, especially with tools like Claude. That you can feed it a bigger prompt with more context, and that definitely seems to help. How did you start kind of learning about what kind of context you needed to provide? And there's the model can produce a result, but the more that you tell it, the more that you educate it on what you want to do and how you want to do it and what you wanted to replicate, all those things help. Kind of what was your progression to learning the tools and learning what you needed to give it so that it could give you the best response?
Yeah, well, it's a mix of a couple of things. I mean, there was certainly a lot of experimentation on my own part, but also there's a really thriving and passionate community around AI writing. There are a couple of other people in that space, probably notably Steph Pajonas and Elizabeth Ann West. Steph runs the Facebook group on AI writing. Elizabeth Ann West and Steph and a couple of others have this platform called Future Fiction Academy. And Elizabeth in particular is very passionate about pushing the limits of AI and seeing just what it could do and like what are the best prompts, because sometimes just changing a word can make a whole difference. And she's really a huge pioneer. I just got to mention her because a lot of what I learned from her. But A lot of it just comes from just a lot of experimentation. And the super prompt that you mentioned, it doesn't work with every model. I find it works best with the Claude 2.0 model. Even Claude 2.1 doesn't work so well with it. But it's a form of prompting where you basically say, here are all the characters. Here's all the background information. Here's what happened in the last chapter. Here's like everything I want to happen in this chapter. Go write the scene. And sometimes you have to prompt it over and over again until you get the actual result you want. But usually, if you're using the right model, the right prompting techniques and everything, you can get a full chapter with just that one prompt. And, you know, it takes some time to set up the prompt, but a lot of the elements like the characters and everything are reusable. So you just sort of swap out a few things and then run it for the next chapter and then the next chapter and so forth. And it's a fun way to write. It's not the only way to write with AI, but it is one of the one of the methods that people often use that I quite enjoy myself. I also use it for articles, by the way. So a lot of the articles I write for my own websites now use a super prompt to get those articles. And I can usually spit out a halfway decent article with one prompt that isn't plagiarizing anything, that covers all of the topics I wanted to cover. Like it's pretty cool.
Jason, when you start talking about using AI to assist you, and I'll very carefully say assist you and not do the work for you, you get some immediate knee-jerk reactions. And I've had this conversation with people all over the spectrum of the writing community. And those Kindle Gold Rushes that we talked about earlier, you start seeing patterns in publishing, especially because that's the industry that we pay very close attention to. I'm sure it happens in all kind of other industries, but this is the one that we know something about. Is that you will see, as soon as someone discovers a new tool or a new way of doing something, all these people rush in to try to take advantage of it. The Kindle store is flooded with sometimes subpar things because people are just trying to take advantage and strike while the iron's hot. And then 6 months later, a year later, you've got this barren wasteland, this war zone where all this stuff is left over and all the people have left because it's no longer, a viable gold rush opportunity mm-hmm. anymore. And so people's first reaction is, well, writing is an art, and how dare you, have a machine try to create the art for you. So that's one argument. And the other one is, well, this is just going to flood the Kindle market and it's going to make it harder for the people that have put blood, sweat, and tears into their writing project for them to get any notice because they've got to wade through all the other junk that's being uploaded to the Kindle store. The reality is, and some of that may be happening. You may have people that have figured out how to, develop a really great super prompt and they're creating a book in an afternoon and, slapping a cover made with Dolly or whatever. And it goes to the Kindle store. And I'm sure that's happening. I'm not here to say that it's not. What do you say to people that have these reactions that people are just going to game the system and we're just going to be flooded with subpar product?
Yeah, it's a great concern for sure. My response to that is, first of all, the Amazon market was already flooded long before AI came around, and flooded with a lot of subpar material too. People just putting out books that are not great, that are frankly a lot worse than what ChatGPT can spit out. Oh, yeah. And those people, Amazon has already got systems in place that are already very good at identifying the good stuff from the bad stuff, because they're already having to sort through, we're talking millions of books a year being published on Amazon, they've got to have some good systems for sorting through, like, which are the actual good ones here? Yeah. And they do that by closely monitoring a lot of, you know, they've got access to insane amounts of data that we could only dream of, right? And that allows them to make really good, informed, data-driven decisions. Now, it's not perfect. You know, Amazon is infamous for having, like, people running scams on Amazon and Amazon coming down with a big hammer, and the big hammer usually squashes a couple of legitimate authors on the way down. And, you know, there's all sorts of
reactions of their own.
Yeah. Yeah. But in general, over the long term, Amazon's gotten very good at identifying what is a quality book. And, you know, I guess some people worried about Amazon, like, going to ban your account if you upload anything with AI. That's absolutely not true. Amazon is building their own AI platforms. They know that AI is the future. They know that people are going to be using it as a tool and not as a replacement. Like you said, there's certainly going to be people out there just spitting out books with ChatGPT, not even reading them, just, you know, whatever. But there, for every one of those, there's probably going to be two or three authors who are using it in a helpful and constructive process. And they know that, right? And so they're not going to ban AI books. And there's been no indication that they would. And what they are interested in is, what is a quality book? And what is a bad book? You know, what is it like? Their biggest concern is the customer satisfaction. So if there are key indicators in the data that a customer is not satisfied with a particular book, that book will be ranked lower. It will not show up. And there you go. So really, there's two things that I think authors need to worry about. And these two things are great equalizers, so that even if the market is flooded 10 times what it used to be, these two things will help. The first is to write a good book. Even if you're using AI to write it, there's things you got to do there. You know, you have to make sure you have good character arcs. You make sure your plot has structure, make sure your prose sounds natural, make sure, you know, all of those things takes time. You can use AI to assist. But in general, it won't do all of those things for you. So you need to make sure it's a good book. That's number one. The second thing is to make sure you have a good marketing plan, because marketing is especially important, especially now. And we're already, like I said, the market's already saturated on Amazon. And the reason we know that is because you pretty much have to use Amazon ads to get a whole lot of traction. And once again, that's normal for any platform. There's always that gold rush period where you can get a lot of organic discoverability. But once things get a little bit more saturated, it then becomes paid discoverability. And that's been the case on pretty much every platform ever. It was the same on Facebook. It's the same on Google. Like, that's just the way it works. And so with that in mind, sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
You're talking about discoverability and
discoverability. Yeah. So it's already a pay to play market.
Yeah.
Which is actually a good thing, because all these people that are just pumping out books willy nilly without even looking at them are not going to have the budgets to properly market those books. And so those of us that do, and who care about our books and have actually made a good book, that converts well when you have an ad that points to it, you know, it becomes the great equalizer that makes it, it kind of just makes all of that extra competition irrelevant. So the only people you are really competing with are other people who have well-written books and who have marketing know-how and budgets and all of that. So sorry, I was talking for a little while.
No.
I get passionate about this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I have really enjoyed using the different chat tools, the different you know, ChatGPT or Claude specifically, is that for me as a writer, I tend to be more of a pantser, but I know a lot about the story before I start writing, or as I'm writing, I hold it all in my head. I know absolutely where the story is going to finish. I know where I'm starting, and I kind of know some tent poles along the way, but I have some weird mental aversion to outlining, to putting it down on paper. You know, it's, I don't know. I have PTSD from 10th grade English, I think. And, one thing that I have discovered, is the way that I can give the AI assistant the ideas that I have and use it to bounce ideas back and forth and help me develop an outline, and then take that outline even further and develop story beats for every chapter, based on ideas that I already have. But I use it as like a writing buddy that I can talk things out with. And, you know, what if we do this? And, oh, I never thought of that. And they're still my ideas, you know, but it helps me to bring that out. And, you know, when I start having this conversation with people and I talk about those ways that AI can be helpful, it takes a lot of people by surprise that they just think that you say, write me a novel about vampires, and bam, there's 80,000 words. But it doesn't work that way. You know, do you ever have you discovered ways that the AI tools help you be the person you already are? If that makes sense at all.
Yeah, I think the best analogy that I can think of is, think back to the first Iron Man movie, when Iron Man is putting together his suit and he's in his lab and he's talking to Jarvis, and Jarvis right. is like creating little things for him, like modeling what he's thinking right there on the spot, so he can kind of like test out a holographic version of it. And he's walking through the steps and troubleshooting right then and there, because he has that sort of Jarvis to bounce things off of. It's very much the same. I have found in practicality using AI, very often I'm just writing and I just get stuck and I'm just like, I don't really know how to choreograph the next part of this fight scene. And I'll just give it to the AI. He's like, here's what I got so far. Can you give me like, 5 or 6 points of where it should go next. And it gives me a whole bunch of things. And, it's never usually perfect, but sometimes just seeing an option, helps your creativity to say, okay, it actually should be this. Sometimes seeing the wrong thing can actually tell you what the right thing is, rather than just having to dream it up out of thin air. Right. A lot easier on the brain, basically, yeah, to go through it that way. And it's very much, it really does feel like Jarvis from Iron Man. Yeah. I think the only thing we're lacking is the actual like conversational element. But that's, I guarantee you, that's going to be coming. Like if not this year, then next year for sure, we're going to get devices like Alexa, but on steroids, that's just able to talk back and forth with you.
Yeah.
Which will be cool. I'm looking forward to that.
It will be. I have discovered that, and this is just my application, that the way that AI has been the most helpful for me is the bouncing ideas back and forth and the helping to shape the outline and story beats, but not so much the prose generation. You know, a lot of times the prose can be purple. Latch on to certain words and phrases and use those over and over again. But I like what you said earlier that, and I've heard you say it before, that sometimes having it generate a first draft, that then you have something to edit, and it's especially if it's based off of your ideas to begin with. You tell it the ideas that you have help me generate this. Now, what's the old saying? It's easier to edit a chapter than you can edit a blank page. You know, and I just butchered that quote, I know, but
yeah,
it holds true. You know, how do you feel about what prose it's able to generate now? And like Samuel asked, how much editing needs to go into prose generation? And do we feel like that generating prose is even the best use for these tools?
It depends on your style and what you want out of the AI. Like I said earlier, I don't prescribe what people should or shouldn't use the AI for. People want to use it for that first draft, I think that's fine. I personally love the outlining process, and I do not really let the AI help with that unless I'm stuck on a certain thing. But I do try to figure out, admittedly, prose is probably the weakest area for AI these days. But I am trying to figure out a easy way to do it that is consistently good. And it depends. Like you were saying, especially if you're using a GPT model, the prose ends up being extremely purple, very flowery, lots of overused words and phrases and just ways of, I call them ChatGPT-isms.
Yeah.
Just things that the more you've been in this, you'll recognize it immediately. But it's those aren't the only models. So Claude is another model out there. And from my experimentations, Claude 2.0 is probably the best model for natural sounding prose. It's not perfect by any means.
Right.
But the amount of editing I have to edit of Claude 2.0 prose compared to GPT-4 prose is significantly reduced. GPT-4, I have to rewrite almost everything.
Yeah.
Claude 2, I can keep good chunks of it, and it does a decent job. The only issue with Claude 2 is that sometimes it doesn't follow your instructions as well, whereas GPT-4 follows your instructions very well. And so, like, I wish I could have a mashup of the two. Something that I'm actually very interested in for the future, excuse me, is fine-tune models. So these are models that have been, as the name implies, finely tuned to write in a specific style. And usually it's like to perform a specific task too. So you have like one fine-tuned model for one very specific task, and then another fine-tuned model for another specific task. And I haven't talked about it too much on my channel or my membership, but it's something I want to get into a lot more in the future. The reason I haven't talked about it too much is because it's difficult to set up. I managed to get one for myself that imitates my writing with the help of a member of my community. And it's what it does is it's a GPT 3.5 model that's fine-tuned for on my writing. And what it does is it can take a piece of the traditionally purple flowery text from like a GPT-4 model and rewrites it in my style, usually strips out all the purple, makes it a lot clearer and easier to read. Sometimes almost a little too stripped down, like it's almost too simple and to the point. Yeah. Where I would actually, I sometimes like the way it phrases things. But I think that is the future of prose. It's not going to be like, oh, you want this model or that model. Like, no, you start with that model, then you fine tune it on your stuff.
Right.
And then it's able to write much more like you. And because I've looked at other fine tuned models that people have created, and the prose from those doesn't sound anything like the vanilla base prose that you get out of ChatGPT or what have you. And I can just envision a future. You know, I was actually talking to one of my coaching clients who was concerned about his own voice. Like, how does he develop a voice? And I say, you don't. You want every character to have their own voice, and they should each say the same. And that's what a lot of writing gurus will tell you. that the key to good writing is making sure every character sounds unique and distinct. Well, I could see a situation where you could have a fine-tuned model for every single character. And anytime you're in their viewpoint, or if you like select their dialogue and say, rewrite this, it'll do so in the style of that character. And you could even like to create a fine-tuned model, you have to create a data set. So you have to give it a lot of examples of like, what does this person's dialogue sound like? Right.
Right.
And from there you can, you know, create your data set, train the model, and then it usually does a good job at adhering to that style. And so like that to me, it almost brings, it almost makes it like a new art form. Like it's an art form, but it's a totally different thing. Like trying to orchestrate all of these different fine-tuned models and how you're going to weave them together into this big thing also makes it interesting. If you're like co-writing a story with someone, if you're using the same models, you can maintain that voice more consistently between the two of you, stuff like that. Lots of cool things that may eventually be possible with fine-tuned models. Like I said, right now they're kind of difficult to create, but I don't think that will be the case for much longer.
Gotcha. Well, right now, fine-tuned models aside, because I agree with you, I think that's something definitely to watch in the near future. But right now, kind of the two big gorillas on the block are ChatGPT and Claude as far as for writing. What purposes do you find each one of those serves best? And I've used a combination of the two of them because one seems to be better at certain things than the other. But if someone is new to this and they have ChatGPT and they have Claude at their disposal, what should they use each one for?
Yeah, great question. So they definitely both have their strengths and weaknesses, and I subscribe to both. I mean, that's partly because I'm an influencer in that space, so I kind of have to be subscribed to both. Yeah. But usually I say ChatGPT and the GPT models in general are much better at following directions and adhering to your guidelines and guardrails that you set up. So for instance, if I give it a structured outline template, so I say, here's an outline template, and then here is my synopsis of my book. Can you make it fit this outline template? It is much more likely to actually do what you tell it to do in that situation and understand your intent and what you want to do there. Where it lacks is in natural sounding prose. But I tend to use ChatGPT for most things that don't require finished prose, right? Like if I'm just doing it for brainstorming or outlining or a lot of things, very often I'll just use ChatGPT because it does a decent job at those things. Where Claude comes in handy, Claude tends to be more creative. And I'm specifically talking about Claude 2.0. Yeah. They did release a Claude 2.1, which is closer to ChatGPT in its sort of rigidness, but really lacks a lot of things that creative writers want. So I don't even use that version. I don't recommend using it.
I remember when it first came out, a lot of people were up in arms. Oh no.
Oh, they were freaking out.
Yeah.
It was a mess. But thankfully you can still access Claude 2.0 just fine. But anyway, what ended up happening is, so to Claude 2.0, definitely better at natural sounding prose, for sure. And tends to be more creative in general. So I will often, if I'm not getting what the results I want on a ChatGPT for things like brainstorming, I will often go to Claude to try again, because it often gives me better ideas that are a little more creative. But as a result of being creative, it is not so good at following directions, because sometimes it just sort of veers off in its own direction. And that's sort of the drawback that you get from it actually being creative. So it's a pro and a con at the same time. And so, yeah, that's really the main differences between the two. It should also be noted, I think, that both the GPT models and the Claude models are fairly well censored. because they don't want you talking about certain topics. Yeah. And to get around that, there are open source models that you can access. Probably the most popular one at the moment is probably Mixtral. But there are others, and people experiment with a whole bunch of them. And those are generally not censored. So you can use them if you're writing, you know, authors, we write things that would normally be considered risque all the time, you know, violent sex scenes, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so those things are usually run into a roadblock if you try to do those through ChatGPT or Claude, but you can use an open source model for those. But the open source models aren't as usually good at the pros.
Sure, sure.
Well, that's the trade-off.
Looking down the road, maybe 1 year into the future, maybe 5 years into the future, what do you predict AI is going to... well, first off, do you have any predictions for how you think it's going to grow? And maybe the other side of that is, how do you think the acceptance of AI tools will start to become in the writing community?
I think the acceptance, well, first, what was your first question again?
How do you think that the AI tools are going to grow, and what features do you think might become commonplace that maybe we can't, that don't seem obvious right now?
Well, certainly we're going to get better and more refined models. I think, you know, some of the big models like GPT-4, as we get like GPT-5 or GPT-6, I'm not actually sure that those models are going to be better for creative writing. In the same way that Claude 2.1 was not better for creative writing than Claude 2.0, right? But I think what we're going to see is we're going to see a lot more models that are created specifically for writing. There's already a couple. And that are better at that. And when they're trained specifically on a specific task, they tend to do way better at that task. So I think we'll see a lot of that. We'll see fine-tuned models become easier to create, for sure. We'll see incorporating with other multimodal capabilities. So we're starting to see this already with ChatGPT, which can analyze images and audio, and it can generate images and stuff. And then I'm sure video will be coming at some point in the future. There's a video AI, but that's one of the things that has sort of got started this last year, but I think will probably be a much bigger deal this coming year. And I just see authors being able to do things that they just wouldn't normally have been able to do, like create actually awesome book trailers, or maybe even whole scenes from their books. As little, you know, with these little AI concept trailer type things, or being able to write, more books or some side books. There's a lot of potential there. And then as far as, general acceptance, I think it will slowly become more accepted, especially because we're already seeing AI just incorporated into everything. And as people use it more and become more familiar, like, I genuinely believe that most of the people who object to AI, if they genuinely spent some time with it and learned how it works in practicality,
right,
and actually learned about the technology and how it works, they would no longer object to it. So I think as more people use it, and we're all going to be using it in some way or another, because every job, every entertainment platform, everything, your phone, everything's going to have AI really baked into it. I think that'll help with acceptance. But I will also point out that I think it's the younger generations, the millennials, the Gen Zers, they don't care. Well, some millennials care, but the Gen Z and like younger generations, definitely, they're just using it. Like, they're just growing up now with this as a major possibility for them. And nobody's really questioning whether they should be using it or not. It's just like, those of us who grew up when the internet was young, right?
Right.
And like, why wouldn't we use these tools? And I think that's the attitude that most of the younger generations have. And I think as those generations get older, the objections to AI will pretty much fizzle out.
Gotcha. Well, one thing for sure, it's an exciting time to be a writer and to be in the publishing industry right now. Jason, this has been such a fun hour that we've gotten to chat. I feel like we barely scratched the surface of all the stuff that we could talk about. Will you come back again and let's, you know, delve into some other topics?
Absolutely. And I'm sure by the time we do, AI will be completely changed. So we'll have a lot to talk about.
Of course. Jason, if folks are not familiar with you and the work that you're up to, tell people where the best place to find you.
The best place to find me is my YouTube channel. It's The Nerdy Novelist. You'll see a big picture of my face. You can't miss it. And everything we talk about there is AI and as it relates to fiction. I'm really passionate about storytelling and how to tell the best story and using the technology that we have to tell that story. So that's what that is all about.
Excellent. We'll link it up in the show notes as well as your other links there to make it easier for folks to find you. Jason, yeah. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun.
That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing. Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.